Good people sometimes do things they regret. They make mistakes that result in legal problems, and sometimes those legal problems even lead to incarceration. But everybody deserves a fair trial. Everybody deserves to face his accusers in a court of law. More often than not, the result is not necessarily desirous. But at the very least, that result might be that the case serves to show the public that the courts are not fair, the process is not fair, and a court of law is not necessarily the place to find justice. I'm John Kiriakou. Welcome to The Whistleblowers. Several years ago, our next guest, Rosa Serrano, was convicted of Medicaid fraud in the state of Texas. Rosa was the owner and sole employee of a small company that made eyeglass lenses. She was accused of overbilling Medicaid, charged with fraud, and found guilty at trial. As you might imagine, there are cases like this across the United States every single day, and they are rarely noteworthy. But this case had it all: jurors who couldn't speak or understand English, ineffective attorneys, questionable jurisdiction, and an incompetent judge who just wanted to get the whole thing over with. In the end, Rosa was sentenced to 11 years in a women's prison, but she never stopped protesting her innocence. Held on fictitious contempt orders, transferred to federal court, held in county jail unless a plea was arrived at, and she decided to do what most whistleblowers do: take her experience and use it as a mantra. She decided to talk about her experience not just to try to find justice for herself, but to demand justice for those Americans who came after her. The American court system is broken, and calling it a justice system, to many of us, is just a bad joke. Rosa Serrano is here today with us. Rosa, thank you so much for joining us, and welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, John. I appreciate your time that you're spending on this issue.
As I like to say, let's begin at the beginning. When did your troubles start, and how did you find yourself in this predicament?
They actually began at the end of 2008, when I brought it to the attention to the state that we were being denied payment on services that were required to be rendered, and the state just brushed it aside, and I kept pursuing it. That was when the stimulus fund for the economy that was about to collapse was sent to all parts of the economy, and Medicaid received a large portion of it. And we didn't receive it as the providers. We did not receive that grant. And I was aware of it because I did. And then I found the grants that granted that money. I did bill directly to the state before, and we saw an increase on those claims. And that money was never sent to us, even though it was designated for those services specifically.
You appealed your conviction a number of times and were denied, not because you didn't have a viable appeal based on actual innocence. You were denied because the judge said you were time barred, you were non-compliant, and that you were perhaps appealing in the wrong court. That was ridiculous, of course, but the courts just didn't want to hear it. So you refiled the appeal. What happened next?
Well, some things are still pending. The courts have splintered this in many cases. I find it surprising, even though I try to keep it as one solid case for one solid issue, is the civil rights of the children being denied their federal right under the Medicaid Act. So there's parts of it that's pending in the Supreme Court, and I'm hoping that the Supreme Court will hear it this time around. And then there's parts still in Austin, and there's still another part here in El Paso. But after I finish with all that, if still doesn't produce any outcome as to launching an investigation, that's the most important part of the conviction, is to launch an investigation. And that should go over again to state, and state will probably send it to federal, and we start all over again. So it's an ordeal. It's a lengthy procedural ordeal. And unfortunately, because of this, people are either dying or very sick, and they need this funding.
You also raised a wide variety of different legal issues, both during your incarceration and after your release. But again, the courts just didn't want to hear it. At the same time, you were being denied your medication in prison, The conditions there were very harsh, and you were sent to solitary confinement. The second prison finally gave you your medication, but they took away your eligibility for parole. You complained all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States. How did you get your parole right back?
It gets given to you after a certain time. It's basically, it took me 3 years to get back into being parole eligible because of what the state had done. They had made it so unbearable for me. My heart condition makes it impossible to work where they wanted me to work, where they had designated me to work, even though I pled with them that I needed my medication. And at that point, they decided that I was not sick, so they took away my medication. And that was even more hardship. And then I just said, you know, I can't do this. I can't be doing this because I'm either going to have a stroke or die, or I'm just going to have to refuse. And their punishment was put me 3 months in solitary confinement for that. And then they transferred me over to the other prison, and the other prison restored everything once they found out how sick I was. But in the process of doing that, they stripped away all my time credits. And in doing so, I was denied the right to be released. Even though I should have only done a year in confinement, but parole decided that they needed to rehabilitate me or reform me a little better. So they held me on longer. And that's ridiculous. You know, no criminal history at all. There's no danger to society. And it's continuing to pursue, you know, that an investigation is launched. And that's been my plea to the courts. You know, I am actually innocent. All I want is the U.S. attorney to come in and investigate and look at what's being done with Medicaid in Texas. And unfortunately, if that's happening in Texas, it's happening across the nation. And I paid a very significant price for trying to bring this forth to the U.S. attorney, and the courts are not helping me with this at all. And that's sad because I've been denied due process. I didn't need to be punished for 3 months because I couldn't work because I was sick.
Rosa, one of the things that has struck me about your case is that you have never been given an attorney. Even though your constitutional rights guarantee access to an attorney, both at the state and the federal levels, how in the world did this happen? And what has been the response from the government and from the courts? They haven't denied that this has happened. So how do they justify it?
They don't justify it. They just brush it aside. They don't address the issue. They never can address the issue that, oh, there is denial of due process because you didn't get an attorney. There is a denial of due process because you didn't get a hearing. I'm required to have a hearing and an attorney appointed to me if the state didn't provide one for me. And the state did not provide one for me in an alternative or another action that was united to this Medicaid fraud charge. It's just El Paso, unfortunately, is very corrupt. You know, the legal system here is as though it doesn't exist and it's not part of the United States. And that's very surprising. So what they decided to do is they tacked on another charge that didn't exist. It was completely fictitious, which is not denied. And they tacked that on, but they decided, oh, well, she doesn't need an attorney. She doesn't need a hearing for that. It's absurd. And I've been pointing this out to the courts, and the courts just sidestepped it. Even though they don't deny that I didn't get the attorney, they don't deny that I didn't get a hearing. They just decide not to approach the subject because then that would launch an investigation. And that, you know, this is two opportunities. You're talking about Medicaid fraud and you're talking about denial of due process. My personal civil rights claims that were denied. And that would launch an investigation. And I don't see why it's so difficult for the courts to just say, well, just give her a hearing and her attorney and have a hearing and you'll find out whether or not she's lying. And if she isn't, then launch an investigation as to what happened. And hopefully the result of that is people will start getting their benefits.
Rosa, thank you for sharing your story with us, but don't go away. We have a lot more to talk about. We're speaking with Rosa Serrano, who served time in prison in Texas and who has continued to fight for her legal rights, as well as for the rights of others since her release. We're going to take a short break and ask why the courts continued to deny her whistleblower status. Please stay tuned.
1950, the USSR was returning to peaceful life, but the newspapers didn't report ongoing massacres in the Ukrainian SSR. According to intelligence, Ukrainian nationalists and the Ukrainian insurgent army, led by Roman Shugievich, perpetrated these atrocities.
Shugievich уже дошел до того, что он в обращениях писал, что убивайте, 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 то есть призывал просто убивать и миллионы.
Pavel Sudoplatov was the head of the NKVD sabotage department at the time. He was tasked with stopping the atrocities in Ukraine for a good reason. General Sudoplatov was very familiar with the situation. He'd had experience fighting the nationalists before the war.
К этому времени я уже был опытным человеком, опытным в области контрразведывательной работы, особенно на Украине.
The task was tremendously difficult, but Sudoplatov was determined to complete it. He had personal accounts to settle with the Ukrainian nationalists. Known in Vietnam as the American War, the Vietnam War lasted for almost two decades and dragged in numerous countries.
Nhưng mà người cầm đầu của Mỹ nói rằng sang Việt Nam là như thế giúp Việt Nam. Và chỉ còn anh em thì không thống kê được.
Hundreds of thousands of American troops were sent to the country to back the South Vietnamese Army.
Máy bay rồi nó xả.
American soldiers murdered resistors mercilessly, burned down entire villages, and spread dangerous chemicals.
Từng nghĩ là những người Mỹ, những người lính Mỹ rất trẻ và họ nhận thức không.
Did the Americans ever fully acknowledge what they did, and are the Vietnamese veterans ready to forgive?
Chẳng nhận là gia đình chúng tôi bắt mất. Trong chiến tranh mà cả quê hương đất nước cũng bị mắc mỡ trong cái sự đau thương của gia Mỹ.
Welcome back to The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We're speaking with Rosa Serrano about her experience in the Texas court system and about her ongoing work to vindicate herself and to help those Texans denied access to Medicare and Medicaid. Thanks again for being with us, Rosa. Good to have you. Rosa, one of the things that has come out of your case is the fact that you are a whistleblower on the issue of access to Medicare and Medicaid. The courts have repeatedly tried to deny you the status of a whistleblower. Tell us how you have fought that and about the work that you're doing now as a whistleblower.
The only thing I can do with the courts is just keep raising the issue. They don't deny the fact that I'm a whistleblower because they don't say it or they don't address the issue in their orders. They just simply don't acknowledge it. But by law, they understand that I do meet the definition of a whistleblower. I am a whistleblower. I continue to be a whistleblower, and I will remain to be a whistleblower even after this investigation, if it's ever launched, because I'm not going to let anyone misuse the Medicaid fund for their own personal use. And that's what HMOs are doing. The thing is that the court's failure to provide me and label me as a whistleblower plays a large part in the investigation. And that's all I need is an investigation. That's all I'm asking for. Investigate. Look at what I'm talking about. Show you where it's at. Here's the proof. Here's the evidence. All of it supports that I'm a whistleblower. If you never label me as a whistleblower by the courts, it's insignificant if you can't launch an investigation. You need to put an investigation forth. And if you decide, oh, well, she is a whistleblower and she's protected and she should have never been prosecuted, Well, that's subsequent now because I've already been to prison. I've already been punished for something I didn't do. So it doesn't matter now whether they label me a whistleblower or not. The only thing is I need the investigation so people can start getting their benefits. It's that simple.
Nobody wakes up in the morning and says, today I'm going to be a whistleblower. It just happens. How did it happen for you on this issue? I know that you have worked with children in the past, including providing them with free eyeglasses. Is that what made you look into Medicaid, especially for children and for the poor?
Well, I was in existing business before all this started. And I was in business for 25 years until I had to close when I became incarcerated. So I've always taken Medicaid in that sense, but Medicaid expanded its programs. So then I was able to advertise and assist more children. But then when this happened, that they were retaliating and removing contracts and denying claims and underpaying claims, and you know, this is the games that they were playing and just finding excuses not to pay claims and accusing me twice of fraud. And I cleared that, you know, twice. Except for this third time, because I was illegally detained without an attorney, without a hearing in jail until I would plead guilty, and I decided not to. And that's where I ended up in prison for that reason. But the kids, I would always attend to the kids and focus on the kids, you know, and this was probably from 2007 up to 2014. That was a majority of the kids that I did help under the program, because at that point we just were, our funding was just totally ending in that part. And unfortunately, you know, parents would come in and replace their eyewear with us, because we did also advertise, you know, Medicaid does provide free pair of eyeglasses. And then after that, if the child breaks them or loses them or scratches or breaks them, they're entitled to another pair. And the concept of the idea of the glasses is for the child to wear them, so they're going to be able to see and be able to academically progress. We're hoping that's the reason why the child is unable to progress in academically, with just a simple resolution as a pair of glasses. So, you know, depleting all my funding and plus not getting paid from Medicaid because I was outspoken about the services that being denied, but I was still providing them. You know, I was having to turn people away, but I did. One child came up to me, you know, pretty sad, and her mom said, well, she broke her glasses, and I explained to her that I wasn't able to offer her any more services because the contract had been pulled and my funds had been completely depleted, and I told her I would charge her a minimal fee to replace the frame because that was what's broken, and we could reinsert the lenses into the frame and see if that would be sufficient. And so she said she was willing to do that because anybody else would charge her something ridiculous. And so I said, okay, fine. We went ahead and did that. The next day, the child comes in, she puts on her glasses, and she turns to her mom, and she goes, Mom, I can see now. And after that, I just said, I need to keep going forward. You know, as trivial it is, as a pair of glasses, if they did this with the eyewear, you know, once a U.S. attorney investigates, how much more damage have they done to these children?
What has been the response, whether by the courts, by law enforcement, or by the media, to your revelations about Medicaid? I know that Fox News in El Paso, Texas, briefly took an interest, but what about everybody else?
Everybody else has been waiting for the FBI or CMS or HHS to come in and say, you know, we've discovered, or the U.S. attorney, we've discovered some fraud, and we've investigated and found that, you know, services were being denied to the children. But other than that, providing the evidence to the media and showing them exactly where the fraud was going on, they simply were saying, we're leery about this because it's just too big of a story and unbelievable that the FBI hasn't taken an interest. And when I went to the FBI, it's just ridiculous what their proceedings are and procedures are about these kind of claims. They're just, you know, they simply go to the state. The state tells them, oh, she's not happy with the reimbursement rate. And, you know, even though I point out to the FBI, this is what the contract says. This is the services I have to provide under the contract, under federal law, and I'm not getting paid for it. But yet the contract says I am going to get paid for it, and they specifically enumerate the claims and the procedures that I'm going to get paid for, and they don't do it. They decide that they're just going to withhold payment for the exact amount that supposedly they announced they're going to pay, but they don't. And the difference is a disparity between what the state pays and what the HMO pays is about $100 to $125 difference that they pocket, that the HMO keeps. This is for services that have been paid for the child to receive. It's not something that the HMO is entitled to. That's a misconception about Medicaid. And this is a misconception that Texas has about this, that, oh, it's okay. We have a contract with the HMO. The HMO can pretty much decide what claim that they're going to pay and not pay, at what rate. And that's what the Medicaid expansion does. It prevents that. And Texas doesn't have that, unfortunately. So until Texas does that, the HMOs are going to continue to manipulate Medicaid. And that's very unfortunate, because the people who suffer are the children.
You have not received any assistance from whistleblower organizations. This is a three-part question. First, where do you intend to go next? Second, would you do it all over again? And finally, what advice would you give to somebody considering blowing the whistle while being under law enforcement's microscope?
Yes, I am going to keep pursuing it, even when the investigation is ever done and successfully and determines that there is fraud and things. I will always be an advocate for Medicaid, because it's essential. I did this for years, John. I saw the children grow. I saw them, how it affected a pair of glasses, as trivial as it was for just a simple pair of glasses. I saw how it was an impact in their life. So my journey is not going to end just by doing this, bringing this as a whistleblower. It's just going to be something that I'm going to continue to do through the courts till I get a resolution, and, hopefully reach out to the U.S. attorney, or the U.S. attorney reach out to me and say, here's the proof. What other evidence do you need? And, if they can see that with the glasses, they need to look into the hospitals, the doctors, the clinics, the labs, everywhere else where this money got displaced. This has been going on since 2008. We're talking about 15 years of corruption, 15 years of losses for Texas. We're not talking a few million dollars. We're talking billions of dollars have been lost for Texas residents. And that's very unfortunate. Would I do it again? Yes. Because I saw what the children went through without the glasses. And I saw how an impact was for them when I was able to help them through those years. And I saw them grow. So you see the investment. You see the growth of the child and how they developed, And they did academically well in school.
Rosa Serrano, thank you so much for joining us. And thank you to our viewers. I'd like to leave you with the words of the great author T.S. Eliot, who said, quote, "Every moment is a fresh beginning," unquote. Along with the immortal words of St. Francis of Assisi, who told us, "Start by doing what's necessary, then do what's possible, and suddenly you're doing the impossible." Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We'll see you next time.